Coming up next, Indiana Public Broadcasting presents another in a series of luncheon speakers at the Economic Club of Indiana in downtown Indianapolis. Duke Energy CEO Jim Rogers spoke to the club on October 31st. Rogers says he wants to make sure that future generations have sustainable energy and a sound economy.
To ensure a sustainable and secure energy future for our grandchildren and our grandchildren's grandchildren, I have two aspirations. First, that we have substantially decarbonized our energy supply in this century. The second aspiration is that we become, as a state, as a country, the most efficient economy in the world.
Duke Energy CEO Jim Rogers addresses the Economic Club of Indiana next. But first, this news.
Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Indiana Public Broadcasting presentation of the Economic Club of Indiana. Today, Duke Energy CEO Jim Rogers talks to members about energy conservation, environmental concerns, and how those factors will affect the economy. But first, we'll hear from Indiana Supreme Court Justice Ted Boehm. Boehm is one of the founders of the Economic Club of Indiana.
Well, I was one of three people that got the club organized. It was an offshoot of the Penrod Society, which by 1974 had become a successful operation running the arts fair out at Old Fields. And we were trying to think about how to add one more interesting little piece of culture and to the Indianapolis scene. And a fellow named John Medvekas, who was one of the Penrod original members, came up with the idea of an economic club. At the time, we thought we'd pattern it on the Detroit Economic Club, which had been in business for a number of years. And at that time, I was president of Penrod, and David Orr, an executive at Indiana Bell, was a vice president. And the two of us went to Detroit, talked to the people who were running that operation, and attended a few meetings, came back and tried to figure out how we could set this up in Indianapolis. And at that time, Tom Lake was the chairman and president of Lilly Endowment. We went to Tom and said, we want two things from you. We want your name on a letter to a bunch of other business leaders, and we want $50. And we want you to ask all of them to do the same thing, put their name on the board of directors and give us $50. He said, all right, he'd do that. And we sent a letter out to leaders from all the major organizations, everything from major industrial companies to law firms and accounting firms and whatnot. And all but one turned and said, sure, we'll do it. And we said, we'll do all the work. All we need is your name and the $50 to pay for the postage and so forth. And then we shot high for our first speaker and asked for Elliot Richardson, who was then the attorney general who had been fired in the Watergate scandal and was serving in the cabinet of President Ford at the time. Asked him if he'd become our lead-off speaker, and he agreed to do that. So he came, and then in the first year we also had Milton Friedman and followed that up with John Kenneth Galbraith the following year. And with those big names who you could get for very modest fees in those days, and Richardson, of course, was free as a public official, we were off and running. And we thought we'd start off with star quality and did, and that was the key, I think, to getting everybody's attention. The early years, we were able, as I said, to get a number of very big names, and some of them were colorful people. And William F. Buckley, Jr. came in the early days and needed a glass of sherry before he'd speak, so we had to scramble around in the then-dry convention center to find a glass of sherry for William F. Buckley, Jr. But most of the large names that came were very accommodating in those days. You weren't in the days of many $1,000 speaker fees, and a lot of government officials were happy to come. And we didn't rely very much on speakers from businesses who, and of course it is important to learn about the views from leaders of industry in central Indiana, and I certainly have happy to have them on the agenda. And we didn't start out with that. We were mostly truly an economic club at that time, and we had leading economics. I've already mentioned Galbraith and Friedman, who certainly were among the most famous in the country. It would be very difficult to get names of that level in today's academe without spending great deals on speaker fees. Oh, I think it's great that they have made it an Indiana institution. We've always had a draw from several dozen-mile radius of Indianapolis as the word got out that you could have an unusual experience here. The economy, of course, is not just globalized but also statized, and we need to think in terms of the prosperity of the entire state. So I think it's good that the state chamber is taking this on. Well, I think it's important in the speaker's selection that you have a balance not only in terms of left and right, but of types of subjects addressed. I think people are interested in broad economic policies and certainly interested in central Indiana industry and what affects it and the businesses in which they operate or the industries in which they operate. But it's also interesting to have people with ideas about the important subjects of the day, education, health care, public safety, all these things are of concern to most people, and I think it's good to have a nice range of subjects and points of views on all those things. I think the Speaker's Committee has done made an effort to come up with a balanced and varied program, and I applaud that. No, I just hope people will show up and enjoy it. It's an interesting way to say, and it's also a nice social event. You end up sitting at a table with people whom you probably have never met before, but most of them are people who are interesting people because they're interested people. So it's usually a pleasant occasion just to meet some new folks from different parts of the community.
Indiana Supreme Court Justice Ted Boehm was one of the three founders of the Economic Club of Indiana. Now we hear from the CEO of Duke Energy, Jim Rogers.
Bridging the divide between industry and environmental concerns is, of course, no easy task. Enter Jim Rogers, Chairman of the Board, President, and CEO of Duke Energy. He is at once the leader of a large power company and a tireless voice for the regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. This requires him to be a self-proclaimed optimist. He operates under the philosophy that the probability that we'll get good solutions to climate change, solutions that benefit both the planet and the industry, is higher if we face the problem now than if we bury our heads in denial. He says that the real challenge with coal is to develop a technology that can eliminate carbon emissions from existing plants, and contends that a lot more emphasis and resources need to be devoted to that innovation. He's an avid proponent of nuclear power, calling it the best zero carbon energy source that can reliably supply our economy. Jim Rogers has more than 18 years experience as a CEO in the electric utility industry. He was named to his current post following the merger of Duke Energy and Synergy in April 2006. Prior to that, he held leadership positions at Synergy and its predecessor, Indiana-based PSI Energy. Earlier in his career, he was a deputy general counsel for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, a law clerk for the Supreme Court of Kentucky, and a newspaper reporter. Rogers is chairman of the Edison Foundation and serves as co-chair of the National Action Plan for Energy Efficiency and the Alliance to Save Energy. He has testified 16 times on energy and environmental policies before congressional committees. His speech today is entitled Energy Efficiency, the Fifth Fuel. Rogers believes that the most environmentally benign plant you can build is the one you don't build. Instead, attention should be focused on a broad array of efficiency measures. Like each of you, I look forward to his remarks. If you have questions as you listen, and you may, please fill out one of the white cards provided on your table and bring it to the stage at the conclusion of his talk. Now please join me in welcoming Jim Rogers.
It's great to be back home in Indiana. I'd like to start out, if I may, on a personal note. This state was the place where I experienced many firsts in my personal and in my professional life, and I'd like to recant a few of them to give you a sense of my where I am and what I believe and why I believe what I do today. I started the first grade in Princeton, Indiana. And 3 years later, I moved to Kentucky, Some of my friends said that was one of my greatest advantages because in Kentucky I had eighth grade reading skills. Now, I'm proud of Kentucky, and all three of my children were born in Kentucky, and I don't think the education system is quite the same, if it ever was. But another first is I was named 19 years ago last week CEO of PSI. I had an opportunity to join a great team of dedicated employees here in the state who had these great Midwestern values, but also had the great opportunity to have Al Barker, who had served before me, stay on the board, work on the board, and help me be better. And Al Barker is 82. Al Barker is here today, and he looks a heck of a lot better than I do. I remember at 41 years old when I was named CEO, they said, you know, he'll never last. And so far, so good. The other thing that I did, one of the first things I did when I came to Indiana in 1989, I joined together with a group of environmental leaders across the state, and we wrote an environmental charter for our country and for our company to lead us forward. It was a collaborative process, and it turned out to be the first environmental charter written by a power company in the United States. And many of the things that I learned in that process, the collaboration, the sharing of the ideas, the commitment to the environment, really grew out of that experience back then. Another first is that we built the first coal gasification plant, demonstration plant, back in the early 90s, where it showed that Indiana was leading the way in finding ways to use new technologies to allow us to use coal. And today we have the next generation plant on the drawing board down in Edwardsport. It's going through the approval process, and it will be the largest, most commercial, the first commercial coal gas plant in the United States, and if completed, will be the most efficient coal plant in our country. The other thing that happened here that was a first for me is we did the merger to create Synergy back in 1994, and it really put us on the road to the company that we are today. And I'll just quickly say that today, in both North and South America, we're the largest owner and operator of power generation. We have over 4 million customers in 5 states. We're the second largest operator of hydro in the United States, the third largest operator of coal plants, and the fourth largest operator in the country of nuclear facilities. On a personal side, I'm about to experience a first as a grandfather. When my oldest grandchild graduates from Cathedral High School this year, Alex has been accepted to the School of Engineering at Purdue, and I couldn't be prouder because we need more engineers in our economy. But I'm also delighted that he's here today, and I will tell you, I guess it's just any excuse to skip school. But Alex is here. Alex, stand up. You know, as a CEO, you get judged every quarter by your performance. You get judged every year with how well you do for your annual report. As a grandfather of 7, I've taken stock of all these experiences and values and boiled down my decision-making process to one simple, conclusive test. When I'm faced with a really big question, and I'm faced with big questions when you think about building nuclear plants and coal plants and where you invest your money and how you maintain electricity that transforms the lives of millions of people every day, I ask myself these questions. Years from now, when my grandchildren look back at what I did today, will they know I did the right thing? Will they look back with pride on the decisions that I make? Will the actions I'm taking today create a better life and a brighter future for them tomorrow? I call that the grandchildren's test. And in every important decision that we make in this country, whether you're a leader in any size organization, in any city, any government, any private, any nonprofit, that should always be the ultimate test for the way forward. To ensure a sustainable and secure energy future for our grandchildren and our grandchildren's grandchildren, I have two aspirations I would like to share with you. And these are aspirations for our country. First, that we have substantially decarbonized our energy supply in this century. The second aspiration is that we become, as a state, as a country, the most efficient economy in the world. I want to thank you all very much for inviting me here to participate in this and to share with you how I think we can start down that road and make those aspirations reality. First, what I'd like to do, just for a minute or two, is to ask you to sit back, put on your seatbelt, and join with me in a voyage to the future. It's now 2020. And I'm still look older than Al. And in 2020, what we have is plenty of affordable energy we can depend on 24/7. We are steadily reducing our dependency upon oil, which is moving toward $100 a barrel. But in 2020, it's moving closer to 30 because of our reduction in our dependency. We have a plentiful supply of energy in fueling economic growth in the U.S. and around the world. The air we breathe is getting cleaner every year. Automakers are often offering consumers lots of fuel choices, cellulosic ethanol, hydrogen cells. But what's really winning the battle is plug-in hybrids. And plug-in hybrids, I believe, are going to be the next generation of cars in this country. And two new Toyota plants, because Toyota is leading the way, have just been completed in Indiana to build these new plug-in hybrids. Indiana, along with the U.S., has become the leader in the world in developing new technologies to produce decarbonized electricity and energy efficiency devices. And this is fueling the growth in our economy. Dozens of new nuclear plants are in operation. The country's first nuclear fuel recycling center is open for business in the southeast. We have solved the spent fuel problem that's been the impediment to moving forward with nuclear, which is the only option to produce electricity with zero greenhouse gas emissions. Wind, solar, and biomass represent a growing share of the generation pie. New battery technologies have been developed, so while it's intermittent and been a problem, when the sun shines, you get solar power, when the wind blows, you get wind power, but with the right storage technology, we can turn that into a more reliable source of supply. New technologies have been developed, growing out of what happened at Edwardsport and carbon capture and sequestration. So now we have the ability to take one of our great resources, use the resource, capture the CO2, and store the CO2. And by using the fifth fuel, and the fifth fuel to me is energy efficiency, by using the fifth fuel, we have cut the growth in demand, the traditional growth that we were projecting in 2007, which is a 40% increase in demand by 2030. We have cut it 50%, but we're still having ample growth because of plug-in hybrids are being used on our system. And plug-in hybrids, you can operate them today at 1/4 the cost of gasoline. We did all this because we transformed our grid. That's the vision. Will it come true in 2020? Not sure. Will it come true in 2025? Not sure. But it will come true. I see it. I feel it. I hear the smart people across the country. I talk to the technologists. I look at where we're headed and what is possible, and I think we can find ourselves on that road. But I think the important question that we have to ask ourselves is, how do we achieve these goals? How do we turn this vision, these aspirations, into reality? I think about the Manhattan Project and how that saved millions of lives at the end of World War II. I think about the Apollo Project. They put a man on the moon. And I will tell you, I've had one great opportunity in my life. And Michael Browning's here, who served on the board of PSI and Synergy and serves on Duke's board today. The two of us had a great opportunity to serve for almost a decade on the board with Neil Armstrong. I will tell you, when there were close votes and I needed his vote, I would start my presentation by saying, one small step. It helped. But think about the Apollo Project. And think about what were the aspirations that I have shared with you today. The Apollo Project, we were optimistic about the promise of technologies and innovation. We were confident that we could accomplish whatever we set out to do. We had the courage to commit ourselves to achieving it. We were unafraid to step away from the status quo and to challenge the conventional wisdom. We had men who were committed to making a dream a reality, willing to risk their lives to make a vision come true. If you know the story of Neil Armstrong, you know the difficulties they had when the technology didn't work. At the end of the day, he had to rely on his piloting skills to actually put that ship on the moon. So even to have someone with that courage and capability is great. And I might mention, he did go to Purdue. That's about the future. Let's beam ourselves back to 2007, and let me have kind of a candid, straightforward conversation with you in terms of where we are today and what we have to get done. But I believe if you can't dream it, you can't do it. And I thought it was important to start with a dream. Today we face one of humanity's most pressing and difficult challenges, and that's global climate change. I stand here today as an optimist who believes we can find a solution to these problems, but we must act now. This issue is at the center of an evolving national dialogue. Look on the college campus. You go to Minnesota and you look at Carleton College and Olaf College. These two colleges are competing with each other to see who can have the most renewable resources, the greenest campus. It's like they were playing a football game or a basketball game, but they're competing to be green. Look at environmental groups and NGOs around the country. You expect them to do that. But you wouldn't expect the largest corporations in this country to step up and call for national cap-and-trade legislation with respect to CO2. Our company was one of the founding members of USCAP, but we joined with GE and Alcoa and DuPont, ConocoPhillips, in basically a situation where business leaders are leading political leaders on an important issue of public policy. Think about this campaign, and this is the longest presidential campaign in my memory. I hope this is the end of long campaigns. It's expensive. But virtually every presidential candidate that's running for office is in a leading position is calling for action on climate change. And it's not a Republican issue. It's not a Democrat issue. Quite frankly, the environment is an American issue. And we need to debate it on terms of it's an American issue, not a partisan issue. Hollywood has even weighed in. They gave Vice President Al Gore an Oscar for his Inconvenient Truth. The European community has weighed in and gave Al Gore a Nobel Peace Prize along with all the scientists of the IPCC, who are the majority of the major scientists around the world, who said the Earth is warming, it's creating problems, we need to go to work. Tom Friedman is writing a book, and I think this is a very interesting thesis, and that is that in the future, the new red, white, and blue is going to be green. And his whole thesis is our country moves more and more toward a stronger environmental ethic, stronger environmental goals, that we're going to have to go to work and walk the talk, and that there are people around this country that are walking the talk and making that happen. Now let me talk to you briefly about the debate. And there's a tough debate going on in Washington right now in terms of how we do it. And the tough part about the debate is that the energy that we use in different regions of the country is different. It has different carbon footprints. And what we have in the Senate today, bills being written by senators from states that do not use coal. They are easily swayed by those who would demonize coal. They are not interested in a transition mechanism as we move from the world of carbon emissions to a low-carbon world, which is what we did in 1990 when we had the Clean Air Act amendments. We built this bridge so all of us who are dependent on coal can make the transition and not pay for the bridge twice but once, but cross over. The head of the Senate today, President Reid, a senator from Nevada, not only doesn't want nuclear, he doesn't want coal. He's against any kind of new sources. It's hard to imagine how states can grow without new generation. The other reality that we need to get across that people don't appreciate is that 50% of the electricity in this country comes from coal. And it's concentrated in 25 states in the Midwest and in the Southeast who are heavily dependent on coal. Here in Indiana, 97% of our electricity comes from the burning of coal. And the way they've structured it, they're going to put huge price burdens on our people in this transition. They could stretch from as small as a 15% increase in prices of electricity all the way to 60 and 75% increases if the more draconian parts of these bills are passed. I'm a guy that wants to get to the other side. I want to cross over the bridge. But I started my career as a consumer advocate fighting rate increases of utility companies when I was in the AG's office. I've really come a long way. But I feel like today I'm a consumer advocate again. And recently when I testified before Senator Boxer, I made the point that, and she's from California, where less than 1% of their electricity comes from coal, and that is that if we're going to make this transition, you cannot punish the people that are dependent on coal, because when we became dependent on coal, there were no laws with respect to CO2, and you've got to give a fair transition to all Americans on this. And in the House, while we have better support, but we don't have strong support because the Speaker of the House is from California, and she has that kind of West Coast-centric view that if it wasn't invented in California, it was never invented. So we have a very tough challenge in front of us to build this bridge to a low-carbon world. We have much work to do. We have work on the technology side, on carbon capture and sequestration. Coal is the most abundant resource in our country. We have a 250-year supply. It's the cheapest source that we have. And as I said, 50% of our homes, our businesses, our computers, our televisions, our way of life are dependent on burning coal. Coal cannot be taken out of the equation. But we're a democracy. And a democracy is built on debate. It's built on bringing new ideas. It's built on creating a consensus as to the way forward. This is a critical issue. We will build a consensus on this issue. We have a lot of work to get that consensus done. Because this bridge needs to get built, and there are lots of questions that need to be answered. But before I drill down specifically on our company, let me step back and give you an international flavor of this. I've been very blessed and lucky to have an opportunity to see this, not just from a third largest coal consumer, third largest emitter of CO2 in the country, an American view. I've been given an opportunity to look at it in a from an international perspective, and I just want to share a few thoughts with you about that, because this is not a U.S. problem. This is a worldwide problem. This is a problem for our planet. This may be the first major challenge that the people of this world have to come together and address together. Many countries have already gone to work on this because they signed the Kyoto Protocol. Many have not. I was given an opportunity because I chaired our industry association, all the utilities in the country, and during my tenure, we were able to change our position to support mandatory carbon regulation. And as an industry, we emit about 40% of the CO2 in the country. And because we were a founding member of USCAP, along with the companies that I mentioned before, calling for national legislation, I was honored to have been asked to join with the UN Foundation and the Club of Madrid, and they put 25 people together. It took 15 former presidents, prime ministers of countries, 10 CEOs from around the world, and they gave us the assignment to draft what the basic principles ought to be when the Kyoto Treaty ends in 12. What principles do we need to bring the countries of our world together so we have a concerted effort? I gained a lot of new insights trying to think through that and look at it from that perspective. It's clearly a global issue that requires commitment from all the countries. And in the UN, there are 192 countries. Let me give you a great factoid that was striking to me. When I looked at our CO2 emission as one company and compared it to the 192 countries, we would have ranked 41st out of 192 countries in our emissions of CO2, one company. I quickly decided I was not going to apply for country status. But it puts in perspective a little bit the challenge and the CO2 emission from our country. But what's complicated about this is there's different countries with different economies in different stages of development, different capabilities, and different abilities to move forward and help. And I can talk about China and India and what's going on there. And some could argue that we could eliminate all our CO2 and they're adding one coal plant a week with no controls, and it won't make any difference regardless of the sacrifices we make to do that. But that's not a good answer, because we need everybody involved. Let me give you one other statistic that's mind-numbing to me that helps put in perspective. There are 1.6 billion people in the world that do not have access to electricity. Think about that. Five times the number of people in our country do not have the ability to turn the lights on and read at night. Do not have the ability to turn the heat on. Do not have the ability to have air conditioning. Do not have the ability to have a computer in their home or a television set. Or do not have access to the modern world. And you think about that have and have nots in the future of their grandchildren. You can see how immense this challenge is, how complex it is. Because we here need to reduce. They need to have access to it, but we need to do it in a way that our planet limits the growth in CO2 and global warming. So this issue is a huge issue, not just for our country, but for our world, and it's going to take time to work through it. And the other thing that I would take away from that is that we're focused on how to mitigate it today, and I think there will be mitigation. We need to do that. And the scientists say 450 to 550 parts per million. I don't think we get there. I think the reality is we're going to have to adapt. But the countries that are most affected by adaptation are really the third world countries, like Sri Lanka and Bangladesh, where they have major flooding and issues. And quite frankly, global warming has uneven impacts on countries. There's some in Canada that say global warming could be a good thing for us. So this issue is a very complex, very difficult issue. And I think that one of our responsibilities is to find a way forward, and it's going to be a long journey. And while the compromises and the consensus building in the U.S. will be great, it will be even greater around the world. Now let me step back and ask y'all to think about what I do in terms of making sure the lights are on. Because job one for me is reliability. And the question is, if that's the case and you're the third largest consumer of coal, and a lot of people see a contradiction in, on the one hand, of being the third largest consumer of coal and emitter of CO2 and calling for climate change, I think I have a special responsibility to lead on the issue, and there is no contradiction. But still, I have to make sure that when you throw the switch, the lights are on. There are only five ways to generate electricity: coal, gas, nuclear, renewables, and what I call the fifth fuel, energy efficiency. Now, I've been criticized by a lot of people by calling it the fifth fuel. I said, you just don't understand. I grew up in the 60s. It might be number five on the chart, but it's number one in my heart. Well, there is some people here from the 60s. But the important point is that when I look at those five choices and try to make that decision, I have four criteria that I look at. Is the technology available? Is it reliable? Is it affordable? Is it clean? And I could take 10, 20 minutes and walk through those five choices to those four criteria, but let me tell you the bottom line. No one of them matches up perfectly to every one of the criteria. One might be affordable, but not clean. Coal is an example of that, until we get better technology. Wind might be good, but it's not reliable. Nuclear is a great answer, but it's very expensive. So each one of them has pluses and minuses, and we have to strike a balance, and we have to keep all of them in the energy equation, because we don't know, as confident as we are in technology,
welcome
which
to
of
the
these
Indiana Public Broadcasting presentation of the Economic Club
to provide
of Indiana.
Electricity
today,
with a zero
Duke Energy CEO Jim Rogers talks to members about energy conservation, environmental concerns, and how those factors will affect the economy.
Everywhere we are.
But first, we'll hear from Indiana Supreme Court Justice Ted Boehm.
Boehm
is one of the founders of the Economic Club of Indiana.
We're going to file in December for a nuclear plant, which is over $6 billion in South Carolina. We're spending $1.6 billion on gas plants. We're spending over $1.5 billion on energy efficiency and renewables. So we are pulling these pieces together and making it happen. I'm proud to be back in Indiana because I'm also proud of the fact of the work that Governor Daniels is doing. I hope you've had a chance to read his homegrown energy plan. It is a very excellent plan. And it maps out a future that, if we can get on that road, will be a great future for our state. And an important part of that is develop the technology. And we hope to do our part by developing the Edwardsport plant, because at the end of the day, that plant will be a critical piece in the puzzle that allows us to use coal and to keep the lights on and do it in an environmentally responsible way. Now, I have a list of things I could tick off here of things that we're doing with renewables. We're purchasing wind from the first wind farm here in the state. We're working with Purdue on how to use cellulosic grasses to blend with what we do. But what I want to do in the few minutes I have left is really focus on energy efficiency. Because while the politicians debate in Washington, while we negotiate around the world to bring the countries together, I think the thing that we can go to work to do today, and I'm old-fashioned, I'm into going to work today, one step at a time, is that we need to really go to work on energy efficiency. And I've come to this belief because I was asked by DOE and EPA to co-chair this National Action Plan to look at what's going on around the country in terms of energy efficiency, what the states are doing, what companies are doing. And the bottom line is, not enough. And the studies show that there's been chronic underinvestment in energy efficiency in our country for many decades. With a 40% growth in demand, I believe we cut that demand with energy efficiency initiatives. The second thing is, it's more economic. And we have a proposal that I believe at the end of the day is cheaper than building new coal plants. While we can't control supply and demand, we can help people manage their energy use better. Thirdly, every time we reduce demand, we're reducing our carbon footprint. And that's a good thing. And fourthly, I believe energy efficiency passes that important grandchildren's test. Let me quickly tell you what we're doing. We have an idea that we call Save a Watt. And basically what it means is for every megawatt we reduce, we create a Save a Watt. And what we do with this Save a Watt is, the way it's going to work, which is different than in the past, and we've really worked on these issues a lot in the past, is what we're going to do is make the investment, take the risk, produce the Save a Watt, and only get compensated if we make it happen. And so it's not about how much you invest, because in the 90s we had a very aggressive demand side management program here, but much of the money was spent to educate people to use energy wisely. And the fact of the matter is, only 15 to 20% of the people, because the bills are low, it's back of mind. And when I lived in Cincinnati, I looked across the street in Procter & Gamble. They spend over $4 billion a year to make sure Tide is top of mind. And spending money to change behavior is not the most efficient way to do it, because if you have $500 of discretionary income, your first choice is not to reduce your fuel bill or your electricity bill. That's not going to happen. We have to come up with a proposal that changes the business model fundamentally. And we have to do it in a way that what we call the Save a Watt, and it's a regulatory model. In the 20th century, the National Academy of Engineers said that the greatest engineering achievement in the 20th century, think about all the things that it could have been, but the one thing that they selected was the electrification of America. My belief is, in the 21st century, with these two aspirations that I started our conversation with today, that we have the capability to provide universal access to energy efficiency, to rich, to poor, to small companies, to big companies, and we're uniquely positioned to do it. We have relationships with our customers. They trust us. We have lower cost capital than most of our customers. We have longer payback periods. And what I'm talking about is putting devices in refrigerators and devices in air conditioning, maintaining your comfort and convenience while at the same time managing your energy use to minimize the need to build new power plants. That is a very important sort of paradigm change that's occurring and that will occur in the future. Tom Friedman, who I mentioned a moment ago, wrote a column in the New York Times about Save-A-Lot. He called it the mother of all energy paradigm shifts. Well, I don't know if it qualifies for that yet, but I think time will tell as to whether it will, because I believe it has the great potential for us as an energy company, a utility company, to change our mission and let our mission not just be building power plants, but our mission to create save-a-watts and to reduce our environmental footprint. And in the old days, think back to President Carter sitting in the fireplace in the 70s with a sweater on and asking people to sacrifice. And when oil prices drop to 30, people forget about sacrifice. When oil prices go to 90, actually, there hadn't been much change in behavior at $90, which is surprising in some ways. Because our country has a tendency to swing on energy and environmental issues between complacency on the one hand and panic on the other end. What we need in this country is a national policy that has a clear, clear view of the vision and is steady, and we're making progress. And I believe energy efficiency will really allow us to make that progress. Part of what we have to do is change our grid, and we're going to do that going forward. We started as an industry that was a high-tech industry, and I believe in the 21st century, as we transform our grid from analog to digital, we will become a technology company again in every sense of the word. Let me close. I want to close with a concept I call cathedral thinking. And I want to put it in a very personal context for you, because I believe at the end of the day, all ideas have to be personal. And people are motivated and do things when it's personal. 10 years ago, on September the 19th, the day before my 50th birthday, my oldest daughter went into labor. We knew it was going to be a girl. And I called her. She lived in Texas. And I said, "Chris, be worth a lot to that girl if you could wait till tomorrow morning." Pretty easy. Just keep those legs crossed. So I got on the plane. I flew to Texas. Got off the plane, went to the hospital, got there about 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And she'd already had the baby. Now, she's the oldest daughter, and oldest daughters like to please parents, kind of the neurotic oldest daughter thing. And she said, "Dad," I said, "congratulations. But I said, I thought we had a deal." And she kind of looked at me through those cold, tired eyes, and she had been in a long, long labor, and said, "Things happen when they happen." And secondly, the more I've thought about this lying here in labor, I want her to have her own birthday and not share one with you, because she needs her special day. But on London time, she was born on your birthday. Fast forward 10 years. I just turned 60. Oh, I left out. I said to her, without editing my comments, and trying to be in the spirit of the moment, that when she turns 10 and I turn 60, I'll take her to London. We'll celebrate on the same day. And so several weeks ago, on her 10th and my 60th, we went to London. And it was a, not often do you make a commitment kind of idly like that and 10 years later are able to deliver on it. It's special when you do it for family. It's special when you do it for friends. But quite frankly, it's special when you honor any long-term commitment like that. But when I went, I had a chance to go to St. Paul's, kind of shorter line. Turns out she'd already been to London. And I hadn't even left the country when I was 25. And then as a grandfather who wanted to make it special, I said, she's already been to London. I need to do something that's kind of new and special. So I surprised her and put her on the channel and took her to Paris, where we had an opportunity to go see Notre Dame. And as I listened to the story of Notre Dame, I was reminded of this cathedral thinking and the kind of cathedral thinking that we really need as a country, particularly on energy and environmental issues. As I listened to him tell the story of Notre Dame, and now it took 100 years to build it. It took 3 generations. Think about the lifespan back then. And that the architect had a vision of what it would look like, but he would never live to see it finished. The stonemasons and the people that worked on the foundation never lived to see the stained glass windows. Those that worked on the stained glass windows and the walls never saw the steeples. And yet, they committed their lives, they committed their energy, they committed their passion, they had faith, they had a vision, and they created something that's a lasting memory. Our challenge is to have that same cathedral thinking. And if we have that kind of thinking, these aspirations of being the most energy efficient economy in the world and aspirations of decarbonizing our supply will be reality. Thank you all very much.
That was Duke Energy CEO Jim Rogers. He addressed the Economic Club of Indiana in Indianapolis on October 31st. You've been listening to an Indiana Public Broadcasting presentation of the luncheon series of the Economic Club of Indiana. Next time, Jim Press will address the club. Press recently left the top post at Toyota North America to become the vice chairman and president at Chrysler. Be sure to join us for that in December. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Mary Hartnett.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.